my panel today. Bobby McDonagh is a former Irish ambassador to the UK, the EU and Italy. Niamh Lyons is political editor with The Times Ireland. Irene Sands is a barrister. Conor Brophy is director of communications at Teneo. And Nora Casey is a broadcaster and publisher. And good morning, and you're all very welcome. So let's go back to John Lyons in the Irish Mail on Sunday. Niamh, you were looking at that.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, the most rollicking read of all the Trump stuff. I mean, Niamh Horan's piece with Mick Mulvaney is interesting because it just really, it's the more sort of sensible definition of what they were attempting to do in Ireland.
And yeah, we apart from the fact that we did learn that in Niamh Horan's piece that Trump had sausages, eggs and a Diet Coke for his breakfast.
And also, as you were saying earlier, the stuff on Brexit and corporation tax. I mean, it was interesting that Trump didn't make this an occasion to pick a fight with us on the 12.5%, but John Lee is the only journalist that managed to actually get his feet under the table at the kind of last dinner slash late lunch that Donald Trump and his wife Melania had when they came back from Normandy. And John described himself as being blessed with the devil's own luck. And it's an unbelievably extraordinary chain of events that brought him to being there on the day. He had been the one that initially broke the story. So in his research a few weeks ago, he was told that anybody who had a booking in the hotel or a tea time, that those commitments would be honoured. So he's an avid golfer himself. So he seems to have chanced his arm and called up the Doonbeg golf pro, a guy called Brian Shaw, who himself was going to be playing golf with Donald Trump.
And he knew Brian Shaw from years ago when he was a barman.
So John Lee was a barman in Gibney's. It's my own local pub as well, out in Malahide. So apparently this guy recognises John. Oh, you're your man who used to be behind the bar. And they reminisced a little bit. And he said, look, I can get you a tea time at 10:36 a.m. Now, that was around the time that Donald Trump was actually flying out. So I'm sure John never believed in his wildest dreams that he'd encounter Donald Trump himself. But it turns out he did what most journalists would do. He kind of hung back, you know, saw who he could bump into. Sure enough, he meets John Deasy, who, as we know, is our envoy to the United States and has been dealing a lot on the E3 visas. John Deasy's quite palsy himself with Mick Mulvaney. All of a sudden, John is introduced to Mulvaney, and Mulvaney's saying, do you want to join us for dinner? So, of course, John Lee obliges. And then just he goes through in very interesting detail, you know, and a really sort of insightful look at how all of the main figures in the administration were interacting with one another. And it really seemed like whatever we say about how this visit was intended, I mean, a lot of people thought maybe Trump was just looking for some big advert for his own hotel. But it seemed like he really did come here to kind of chill in between the more kind of pomp aspects of the British state visit.
But Bobby McDonagh, as an ambassador and a diplomat and everything, that dinner down in the clubhouse in Doonbeg seems very random, doesn't it? So you could kind of wander in. There were no real high flyers from Ireland there. And Trump seems to have just had a casual dinner and then wandered off. And they're a very random kind of affair, wasn't it?
Yeah, look, I don't know the details of it. I think our ambassador in Washington, Dan Mulhall, was at it. Yeah. But I think that's probably the way the Trump White House operates. It's not probably, you know, all that structured and you know, looking after the minutiae of these arrangements. And also, of course, it was, as Niamh says, he was hoping to chill when he was down there. But overall, I think the Business Post editorial is right that the Taoiseach deserves credit for this. I mean, the visit passed off well. Irish-US relations are intact, possibly even improved. And I think maybe the way to look at it is that different people were trying to get different things out of the visit. I mean, Trump was trying to chill, but he was also presumably looking to the Irish-American vote and looking for publicity for his hotel. The government wanted to maintain the really important friendship between our countries and maybe to make some gentle points about the European Union and Northern Ireland. The local people wanted to celebrate a local employer, and the protesters wanted to protest about the visit. So, you know,
everybody got what they wanted.
But I think it's important to distinguish between what one thinks of Trump as a person and as a politician. And Tom McGurk in the Business Post refers to the wrecking ball of the Trump presidency. But how you handle a visit is a different question. And I think, you know, there may be a family which has a brash, curmudgeonly and not much loved uncle, but if he comes to Christmas lunch, you want to get through the thing, you know, in a friendly sort of way. So I don't, look, it's good that it passed off well, that he deserves credit, but it doesn't mean that most Irish people buy into the Trump view that we should have a sort of narrow form of nationalism replacing the multilateral institutions, which are so important for our country.
And there were protests and people made their feelings known about all that. Conor, you were looking at the Sunday Independent, Niamh Horan's interview with Mick Mulvaney.
I was, yeah, which is a great piece. And there's a couple of interesting things in it. First of all, this notion of the 18 and 20 hour days, and yet Nick Mulvaney still manages to keep an 8 handicap on the golf course. And Donald Trump apparently is even better, the greatest short game that Nick Mulvaney has ever seen. So I need to read.
Now Donald Trump does cheat, doesn't he? There was a whole book about it recently, I think. And I think everybody just lets him cheat.
But yeah, I think even as Donald drives off, he's heard to shout, "No mulligans, no mulligans." But I think he apparently take quite a few mulligans. It's probably no mulligans for anybody else. But actually, to Bobby's point, like, two things happened last week. The President of the United States came to visit and Donald Trump came to visit, and they both needed to be managed in two different ways. You know, if the President of the United States wants to drink Diet Coke with his fry, then the President of the United States gets Diet Coke with his fry. Whatever we might look on that as a personal choice, who drinks Diet Coke with a fry? But I think, as Bobby said, we managed both of those things quite well. The Mulvaney piece is interesting, though, as you were saying, in that sort of very hands-off approach to Brexit, very deliberate comments that he makes, steering clear of any kind of controversy around corporation tax. You know, it's not coincidental that Donald Trump comes here in a pre-election year, no more than Barack Obama came here in a pre-election year. Ronald Reagan came here in a pre-election year. JFK came here in a pre-election year. I think Elliot Spitzer opined once when he visited here in his own push for a gubernatorial position in New York that you need to have three eyes in American politics. You need Ireland, you need Italy, and you need Israel. And so, you know, there was, I think, a pretty deliberate attempt not to do anything offensive here, and that seemed to pass off.
I saw a piece in the Journal, I think, in the last couple of days, contrasting the Trump visit with other recent visits. Barack Obama's last visit here was not an official state visit, apparently. He was here for less than, he didn't even overnight here, yet he was regaled from one end of the country to the other. It was in stark contrast to that, wasn't it, Nora?
It was, and I think, look, if Barack Obama was coming here, I heard, you know, there was the story about the fact that Leo Varadkar had a little side meeting with him when he was over in Washington at St. Patrick's Day, and I thought, you know, actually, if Barack Obama had come here last week, and especially if you'd taken Michelle Obama, the streets would have been mobbed with people out to welcome them. I think just to lower the IQ a little on the discussion, like, this is a man who's ridiculed people with disabilities, homophobic, misogynistic, who separated children from mothers. And although I accept this whole separation of the president from the office, I think that he doesn't respect his office. And therefore, I think that we have freedom not necessarily to respect him. He hadn't even landed in London and he was putting out childish tweets about the mayor, Sadiq Khan. He had only left Irish airspace and he was putting out a stupid tweet about Mars being part of the moon. So I don't know what you think you're talking about, saying that he has some greater plan for Brexit. The only thing I saw was him saying in a press conference, you'll do well with your border, with your wall, and a pregnant pause before Leo Varadkar butted in and said, actually, we don't want a border or a wall. I think he was very poorly briefed.
Saying is, I'm not getting involved in this.
I thought he was poorly briefed.
Yeah. Do you think we should not have welcomed him?
No, I do think the people of Dunbar, this is a private visit. If ever there was evidence of the fact that he wasn't wasting too much time on Irish affairs, is that dinner. That he had a whole load of odds and sods sitting at that dinner, rather than trying to do a more formal dinner while he was on the island of Ireland to try and broker relationships. He didn't really give a toss about being here, other than he was going
to. Well, did we offer him a formal dinner?
I don't think he wanted it. It wasn't a state visit. He made it clear his whole visit was about the UK, about D-Day. He came over here. We had a big fuss about it because that's what we do. We tried to make out that it was bigger than what it was. It wasn't. There was a short press conference where I felt he got it all wrong and said all the wrong things, and we tried to make out that this was wonderful and that the relationship was even better than before, and we paid $10 million for it.
Anyone agree with that or disagree?
No. I think it was a success.
Irene?
I think the trip was a success. I think, to pick up on something that Conor had said, I don't think anything that Trump does is coincidental. I think he's a lot smarter than people give him credit for. I think he has all of his bad faults, don't get me wrong, but I certainly think that this trip could be deemed a success. And I was talking about it yesterday with my brother-in-law, who is an American, and a Republican, not necessarily a Trump supporter, but a Republican. And the mood and the attitude, certainly on the state side of things, is that, and I thought it was kind of comical, that his speech in relation to D-Day and all of his actions were almost presidential, and that he conducted himself particularly well.
It's the most presidential we've ever seen
him, exactly. Yeah. And I know that's there's something comical in that, but at the same time, I have to say, I think credit has to be given to the people in Doon Beg. I think they put out a welcome for someone who is a significant investor and contributor to what is a very rural area. I don't think many people would even know where or what Doon Beg is without Trump and without his investment. And there was a very interesting comment in Saturday's paper, actually in the Irish Times, where one of the local men, Tommy Comerford, indicated that he basically said, like, you can see that the hotel is the lifeblood here and that we're totally dependent on the tourism. And he was kind of hitting back at the media backlash about, you know, they shouldn't have maybe rolled out the red carpet for him as much. And he said, you have to look at it from our side.
Niamh Lyons, were you people in the media a bit mean to the people of Doon Beg last week? Snooty?
Maybe we were. I mean, I think the whole idea that perhaps they weren't in the loop themselves on this one and kind of, you know, milking it for all that it was. I mean, the fact that there are so many spin-off businesses from Doon Beg, and I mean, let's not forget, the actual village is ages away for anyone who's ever driven it from the hotel. So there's a spin-off business, restaurants and pubs. So that means
that... Is it ages away?
Yeah, a good bit away. It's kind of, it's definitely not walkable for anyone who's ever been down at a wedding down. you have to kind of jump in a cab.
Depending on what shoes you're wearing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You can't clip-clop your way down for a late lock-in down there anyway. But the idea that all these businesses have been spin-offs means that families are still together down there. It means that people don't have to leave to come up to Dublin to work. It also means that grandparents don't have to Skype their grandkids over in Australia when they have to leave to work. So if that's important to them, then it is. I mean, to come back to Bobby's earlier point about the Taoiseach, I mean, you could see him, you know, biting his tongue on a few occasions. The exact same thing happened in the Oval Office in March when Donald Trump mentioned that he would start a trade war with the EU. And the Taoiseach basically had to come in and say, well, look, I know you want a trade deal with Britain, but there's 500 million of us across the European Union that will do a deal with you far quicker and with far better outcomes. So we definitely did see a bit of mettle from Leo Varadkar there in kind of managing that situation, because, I mean, the eyes of the world on him, and he has to pick up something that could actually damage, given the fact what's going on with the leadership race in Conservatives. I mean, if he hadn't clarified that point about the border, it would have fed exactly into the campaign that's ongoing over there.
Mm. Okay. Conor, did you think that Urban Ireland showed fundamental misunderstanding of rural Ireland over the past week?
I do think there is a bang of the urban-rural divide about it, yeah. And it was certainly very evident on Twitter at various times during the week that, you know, to Niamh's point, you drive around so many towns still, so many years on from the recession, look at the number of shuttered premises there are. Like, it's a blight on the landscape. And it's very easy when you're sitting in Dublin, which has benefited from an influx of foreign direct investment that would be the envy of the Western world, from pharmaceuticals, from tech companies, you know, to the point where we're now dealing with the problems of success with surging rents and so on. It's very easy to look down your nose at people who are welcoming a foreign direct investor who put in money into Doon Beg when nobody else was willing to do it. I saw the principal of the national school talking about how they've gone from 25 kids to 56 kids. They have an extra teacher, you know, and as Niamh was saying, that's keeping families in the area. It's keeping businesses open.
And I think
I
heard that for 5 pubs down there, none of which, by the way, Niamh Lyons do late lock-ins, okay? Let's just clarify that. 3 restaurants, 3 shops, a cafe, like, which is kind of extraordinary for a small place like that, totally due to 300 jobs up there and rich golfers.
I would say, Brendan, I did feel that there was a dominoes between Dublin and rural Ireland. My mother's from Leitrim, and there's parts of that country that can't sustain one pub in the village, let alone 5. So what I think is a travesty, though, is that we're relying on Donald Trump to actually bring that tourism to Doon Beg. You can go to Kerry 165 days, you'll see it's a roaring trade. I just do a shout out and say Fáilte Ireland put out a thing about 2 weeks ago saying they had 150 million for tourism ideas to rival the Titanic, minimum of 2 million, to take people to areas of the country that are no, that are not fed by tourism at the moment, not to distract from areas that already have tourism. So we need people to come out with imaginative solutions for Donegal, for the West Coast, for areas like Doonbeg, and manage our own tourism. We shouldn't be relying on an American ambassador.
In fairness, I think the people of Doonbeg were very much, you noticed they called it the project all last week, the people of Doonbeg were very much behind getting that hotel built and everything. Are we reliant on Donald Trump just because he was the one who came in and bought it when, as Connor says, nobody else
but
was willing to?
But I'm just saying,
this is a community that clearly did pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
I think, Brendan, I mean, the people of Doonbeg had every right to welcome the president the way that they did, even if I think it was maybe a step too far for the local priest to promise places in heaven to Trump and members of his family. but likewise, people elsewhere in Ireland had every right to criticise President Trump and have an ongoing right to criticise Trump. I think it's worth maybe mentioning that he was also on his best behaviour on the visit to the UK. Not perfect behaviour, because as Nora said, he was very critical of the mayor of London in an
who had
now,
let us not forget, called more or less called him a 20th century fascist before he came. So I mean, do we? Well, can we be guilty of not having equivocation on the behaviour of one side versus the other here?
You mentioned, or somebody mentioned, you know, biting your tongue. Sometimes, you know, biting your tongue, especially if you're in a position of high responsibility, is better than tweeting.
The mayor of London isn't in a position of high responsibility.
But sorry, he criticised his stature. It would be okay if he had a debate about fascism. He said, "You're a Stone Cold loser, and you're half the size of Bill de Blasio, who's the mayor of New York." So that's how childish his comment was.
You think calling someone a fascist is...
Well, I'm just saying, if he wanted to rebut it, he could have come back with a, you know, a more intelligent comment on why he wasn't, rather than criticising somebody's physique.
Okay.
My basic point, though, is I think that you know, Trump wasn't his best behaviour. He delivered the set speech at the state banquet of the Queen, which is not something that he always does. He stuck to the script. He didn't have a photograph taken with Nigel Farage, which I thought was quite interesting. I mean, meeting Farage is inappropriate in the context of a state visit, but in terms of the way Trump generally behaves, because a state visit is between the institutions. It's not, you know, an opportunity for promoting relations with an opposition leader.
Or but potential future prime ministers.
Or unless they happen to be Jeremy Hunt, who's the foreign secretary. But my point, I thought it was quite interesting that there was no photograph with Nigel Farage. I mean, that was showing a certain restraint on his part. And I think the British will also have been quite happy with the way it passed
off. I think one interesting point I saw was Roisin Ingle on Twitter during the week tweeted the article, which I actually thought was kind of a nice moment. The teacher who brought the kids to the ninth hole to meet him. And I suppose, you know, you can argue that maybe we shouldn't have spent 10 million protecting him, but those type of stories get a global audience. And I don't know if we could pay for the type of publicity that little corner of Ireland has had over the last while. And, you know, I guess I thought it was sort of one of those moments that those kids will remember for the rest of their lives. But Roisin Ingle's point was, you know, we should teach kids how to recognise a bully. Now, speaking to Connor's point about, there was two different people here. He treated us as well, or as we could have hoped, in during the press conference. I know he made the mistake about the border and the wall, but the idea that he didn't attack us about our corporation tax meant that he was attempting to kind of hold back, and I suppose to be as diplomatic as he knows how to be. It's interesting as well when you talk to the different people that would be involved in the preparations for these visits. They always say, I'm always interested in kind of what level of knowledge that he has about Ireland. I mean, if you think about it now, he's met Enda Kenny for the first time when he first came into office. There's been numerous meetings with Leo Varadkar ever since, but you do get the impression that you're kind of starting from a fairly basic level of understanding each time, and that he's almost just briefed moments before and then he's able to sort of repeat that again. But he did give us a fairly interesting commitment on the E3 visas. I mean, he described himself as having spoken to Tom Cotton, the Arkansas senator, and said, like, don't think badly of him. You know, he didn't do it to be spiteful. He just has his concerns. He loves Ireland. And we're now expected to believe that Trump
is going to
get this over the line in Congress, which it will be huge if that happens. It will mean And we have access to a greater amount of visas that are the leftovers from the E3s in Australia. So, like, if he manages that for us, then that trip can only be seen as a success.
I think Niamh Irene pulls on something very important. It struck me. So Joe Russell is the manager of the hotel in Doombeg. And in relation to the kids, that it's a real Irish kind of an Irishism. Mm. The kids that were at the ninth hole were there with the principal, whose father, I think, owned the adjacent land. Like, and that's how she was able to go to the ninth hole with the kids. And Joe Russell very smartly turned around to Donald Trump and said, look, this is the future of Doonbeg. These are kids from the local school.
He said, they're your future employees.
Yeah. Well, he's probably true. Like, there isn't a whole lot of opportunity in Doonbeg aside from that. But to that end, Trump, you know, he didn't rebuff them. He actually asked them to come down. And I think it was, I just think we saw more of the human in Donald Trump some of the good human in Donald Trump as opposed to some of his other attributes.
Have you warmed up hugely to Donald Trump in the last week?
I have a little bit after this visit. Now, the only thing, I'm going to have a little pop at you on this one, Brendan, which comes back to the rural-urban divide. When you were reading out the headlines, and this was actually the first headline that got me. Doonbeg, Egypt's and other stories. Brendan O'Connor.
Now, we have a policy here that I'm sure I'll do with my stories, but like, you will understand, you will see, if you read it down the full 500 words, you will see that I'm not calling
you. No, I totally get that. The only reason I mention it is because you actually draw a very interesting parallel between the rural and the urban attitude to the visit.
I should stop you, but go on. We'll give you 30 seconds.
I'm coming from a very rural country bumpkin side of things. I have to say, like, I'm from a small village myself. I think Doonbeg really put them, like Niamh says it, you couldn't pay for the type of publicity. And certainly I touch base with my sister and my brother-in-law in the States, and I was kind of like, how was the visit perceived? And the one thing he said was, like, there was just these amazing views of the Donald's, you know, golf course, but Ireland was portrayed like immaculately, and it's something Fáilte Ireland would pay a fortune to try and do. And I think, yeah, I probably have warmed a little bit more, and that's not taken away from all of his bad attributes, of which there are many. But I think this visit definitely has to go down.
Can I just make one point? We're talking about Doonbeg, and it's the tiniest thing really compared to the elephant in the room for his visit and why a state visit should happen, and that's our multinationals and our reliance on corporation tax. So here we are saying, and thank the goodness that he didn't bring it up. He has to bring it up. We have to talk about it. The G20 has just announced that the way in which corporation tax is going to be measured from 2020, just around the corner onwards, is not going to be about where their profits are. It's going to be where they create their value. So in other words, they're signalling a severe downturn
to
in corporation tax.
Huge profits through places like Ireland.
He's already said, you think you're getting it over there for 12.5, I'll bring them over here. But actually the G20 has said, all right, all bets are off the table. It's not going to be for physical sales, because actually when it comes to Google and Facebook, it's where the ideas emerge from. Where do you create the ideas? That's where the tax is going to occur. So Dan O'Brien is out on Twitter today saying that the Irish government from 2020 onwards needs to be taking down significantly the tax take from corporation tax.
Because a lot of what is funneled through here as taxes is intellectual property stuff, is it?
And it's sales. So they say that the sales happen in Ireland and therefore the tax should happen in Ireland, because we might only employ, by the way, a tiny amount of people that they employ worldwide. But, you know, in Silicon Valley could be where all the creation of ideas comes from. So they've actually said you have to pay tax regardless of their physical presence or measured profits. So it will decimate our taxes. And if there's one common shared area, of course Doonbeg employs people locally and it's very important to local people. But for the whole island of Ireland, it's very important that we sit and have that conversation.
So you think we need a state visit?
We need to have a proper conversation with him about that, because the two countries that are most affected is the US and Ireland. So the creation of the
ideas. So you think we could find common ground with Donald Trump here?
We have to. We've no option. That's the deal that we need to strike in the future.
Except I think Donald Trump views economics and trade as a zero-sum game, that there's a pie there, and if you're getting some of it, that means I'm getting less of it.
I agree.
And I mean, that's pretty much what Mick Mulvaney's saying today, which is that they view the corporate tax situation as a kind of a competitive rivalry in that way. And he does say as well, he says
The only thing I'd say that he has rejected the G20 outcome on this issue, so he doesn't see it as favourable to the US either.
Now, before we leave this, Conor, there is in the Irish Mail on Sunday As always, there's a Healy Ray angle to this. Just tell us about that.
There's a Healy Ray angle to everything, yeah. It turns out that Healy Ray Plantire has two water contracts in Doonbeg worth €1 million. And Danny Healy Ray says, I don't begrudge the people of Doonbeg for taking care of someone who's putting food in their mouth. And he's certainly putting food in the Healy Ray's mouths too, it seems.
Okay, and we'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Bobby McDonough, Niamh Lyons, Irene Sands, Conor Brophy and Nora Casey. And let's move on to domestic politics now. Conor, you were looking at a piece in the Sunday Business Post. Bring back Bertie, says Fianna Fáil ward boss as he quits after shocking poll result.
Yeah, this is Brian Moan, Fianna Fáil in Dublin Central, which has not returned a TD for Fianna Fáil in 8 years and in a couple of elections. And all the candidates, of course, in the locals failed to get elected there, I guess in contrast to the wider Fianna Fáil performance. But his answer to this is that, look, you don't get elected without having members on the ground to work the constituency. He's referring back to the famous Drumcondra Mafia and the Bertie machine. I thought there was an interesting wider point in this, though, in that if you look at what happened in the locals, I mean, it's remarkable that we're talking about, say, Fine Gael adding seats. I think the first time in 20 years a sitting government has actually returned a greater number of councillors in the local elections. We're looking at one of the big stories being that Sinn Féin, that was nearly treated like it was in government and got the backlash from the electorate, having half the number of councillors. But it just goes to show you that nothing stands still. You know, that the lines that we had looked like the inexorable or seemingly inexorable Sinn Féin growth trajectory that we'd all assumed would keep going. You know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The sort of electoral success that Sinn Féin has enjoyed clearly attracted the attention of the other parties. I think one of the things you've probably seen is that Fianna Fáil, for one, has realised that the only way to combat that is to roll up your sleeves and to actually outwork on the ground, which is probably something that you've seen across the country.
And something that Sinn Féin are very, very good at.
100%. And the other parties have learned from that. So that greater Sinn Féin platform attracted greater scrutiny. And it also, you know, it's a competitive marketplace for ideas out there in politics. If somebody seems to be doing well with something or with a particular behaviour, okay, it gets aped very quickly. And you've seen that probably.
So there's little sustainable competitive advantage there. The others will just copy if they see you.
100%. Yeah, there's very low barriers to entry, and we're seeing that.
Niamh Lyons, he talks about the so-called milk roan there, which is apparently out covering the place in leaflets in the morning. Yeah. And he says they'd be lucky to get 10 people out in the milk roan now. And in Bertie's day, there were 50 people out doing the milk roan every morning during the election.
From the kind of more macro picture, that's a challenge all parties are facing. I suppose if you look at the reason we have the makeup of the current Dáil that we have, it's because party support is changing, you know. And I suppose if you look at the way people used to vote 50 years ago, you know, those people have not, you know, trickled down the same type of loyal support to their children and grandchildren that they would have had for the Lamasses and the Hawhees of this world, despite the fact that there were those names actually running on this occasion in the local elections. I had to kind of laugh reading that piece this morning because I wonder whether Mary Fitzpatrick would lament the collapse of the Drumcondra Mafia. I mean, obviously, Bertie Ahern, as the kind of Taoiseach and figurehead of that particular area, there's always going to be a certain level of success. But I guess, you know, like any great kind of kingdom or fiefdom or whatever, you know, that has had its day now. But look, they've just elected Paul McAuliffe, a Dublin mayor, he's probably going to give someone a very good run for their money in the Dublin Northwest constituency in the next occasion.
And Fianna Fáil did claw back a lot in Dublin.
Yeah, that's
this
a
time,
huge story for the next general election. And it's exactly where they needed to be strong.
Nora.
I grew up in the Phoenix Park, just at the gates of the North Circular Road. And Bertie started life in the finance department in the Mater Hospital. So very much a very local, you know, constituency guy. And I wonder whether first of all, I'd say Bertie is back. I mean, he's out all the time talking about Northern Ireland and about other issues, so he's definitely not.
Yeah, he's back in the media, but he's not back in the party. And the party, I think, approached about this piece, said no plans for him to be a member again.
But what I would say is this: the community that I grew up in Stony Batter, which had, you know, my family were Fianna Fáil, by the way, and we had all of these Saworth families that were very close in the community. You won't recognise the people living in Stony Batter now. It's all yuppified. Like, I go into a pub down there that was my father's pub, and it's full of young people, and they're coming from all over the country and all over the world.
And
It's fantastic, and they're different constituencies, and I don't think that Fianna Fáil has recognised that. It's not about the milk run anymore. It's actually about, you know, they're not good in social media, I'll tell you, 100% not good in social media. There's another piece, as you know, about of Radke and the Stars in the papers today. And whatever you say about him, he's a big social media guy. He didn't need any lessons from Trump about how to use social media. Fianna Fáil is still archaic in the way that it treats elections.
I think there are differing opinions on how important social media is in elections in Ireland still. But yeah, Bobby.
Yeah, Brendan, I don't have any political affiliation. I was a civil servant until a year ago, and it's been my privilege to work with distinguished politicians from all the main parties. But I had the privilege of working closely with Bertie Ahern on European issues, and he is a remarkable negotiator. He's a strategist. He has a capacity to get on with whoever he's dealing with, and he also has a self-confidence in his dealing with public servants. And he also has a sort of work ethic, which some of the politicians have, but not all of them.
Almost
do.
Trumpian, would you say?
No, but he works, you know, he digests the briefs. He goes into meetings, both domestic and international, better briefed than the people he's meeting. So, look, people may have different views, and certainly there are other admirable Irish politicians, but I hope he still has a role to play in public life here.
I think Nora has made a very valid point. I think the nature of campaigning has changed, and I think there, some of the old school parties haven't really moved with those times.
But Irene, Fianna Fáil had a really, really good local elections this time. That's the thing we can't forget. Also, Liam Weeks has an interesting piece in the Sunday Independent where he says that there is now a new Ireland, which is in Dublin, and an old Ireland, which is down the country, and that actually that fragmentation hasn't happened so much down the country. There are hardly any left-wing seats in councils down there. The proportion is very low. And that the two parties, the two-and-a-half party system is still quite
strong. Say that's
working
true.
Down there. Yeah,
absolutely. What I will say is, so again, I'm from what would be a very staunch Fianna Fáil family historically. I'm not in any way politically inclined myself, but my granddad was director of elections for Fianna Fáil. So, like, you're talking about Charlie Haughey. Like, I remember literally all of us being drafted out to go out like canvassing and campaigning, and like we had Charlie Haughey stickers on our bikes and all this type of stuff. Like you don't see that now, you don't see that anymore. I also don't think people really want a knock on their door at 7 and 8 o'clock in the evening.
Certainly
to listen
not.
You know, to listen to the local, yes, they want, you know, they want to know about the potholes being fixed and all the local agendas, but they really don't want the intrusion in the way it would have been sort of back in the day, for want of a better way of putting it, and come in and have a cup of tea and we'll chat about the issues. People don't want to be disturbed at home anymore, and I think the nature of campaigning needs to reflect that.
It's so true. I mean, I tell you, when I get in the evening, wrecked after a day, all the way through the local elections, my buzzer on the door, and I have an intercom, and I would say, sorry now, I'm just cleaning the house, there's nobody here.
I just don't answer the door. I don't answer the door. I live in the country and I don't answer the door.
Kids no longer even ring doorbells. They now WhatsApp each other going, I'm at God.
Yeah, yeah. That's what politicians should do.
Yeah. That's probably what Leo does. Like I see somewhere today a Fine Gael insider saying Leo is the hippest Taoiseach we ever had. Conor Brophy, you were looking at that piece in the Sunday Business Post. Yeah. It's kind of related. What's in the stars for Leo?
One point I just wanted to make from what we were saying there, though, the level of political engagement and political activism among younger people is much higher than I can ever remember it when I was in my late teens and early 20s.
We've had this
on issues, but it's just, rather than
exactly,
on party.
It's just not party political. Like, we saw it with the Repeal the Eighth, we saw it with the Marriage Equality Campaign, we saw 15,000 kids protesting on climate action, and we know that all their parents are engaged as well because they were picking them up or dropping them to the protests.
Apart from the Green, not quite a green wave, the overstated green wave, no party has really managed to get credit for any of those movements or managed to piggyback on them.
But it'll be very difficult to manage, though, because, I mean, and it calls to mind a quote from Jean-Claude Juncker in a very different context during the recession, where he said, we all know what needs to be done, we just don't know how to get elected after we've done it.
There's also a lot of musings, as we know now, in the sort of left of centre parties. You know, you've Sock Dems doing pretty well in the locals, Labour, a sort of slight resurgence there, and the Green Party. And is there any point in having these three groups eating themselves alive in the same constituencies at a general election, or should they somehow come together? And I don't think it's going to be, sort of another Democratic left moment, but I do think there will forevermore be an alliance and probably an electoral plan conducted by those parties.
Which Sean Sherlock actually did the day of the, before the results were even filtering through, I think, had come out and said that Labour and the Greens should join up. Anyway, Conor, you tell us about that.
Sorry, piece, what's in the stars to that piece for Leo. By Michael Brennan, who looks at a couple of recent celebrity engagements that Leo has had, be it the LCD sound system, which actually turned out to backfire slightly, the writing the letter to Kylie Minogue, being pictured on his way to the Spice Girls. I suppose you could probably include meeting Donald Trump as a celebrity moment as well. But as that insider is quoted as saying, he may be the hippest Taoiseach we've ever had, but there's probably a bit of the urban-rural in this as well. Like, is that as appealing elsewhere in the country as it seems to be with the hip?
I mean, end of a Springsteen.
He's coastal elite. It was the contrast, which I thought was quite funny, to Leo at the National Ploughing Championships trying and failing to manage the horse-driven plough, which, to be honest, I think many of us would fail to master, but the headlines he got out of that one.
Yeah, and they contrasted with Micheál Martin, who doesn't really have a persona and believes that policy is more important.
And that I thought was quite interesting, the idea that, well, at least you have an idea of Leo the person, what motivates
exactly,
him, what he stands for and what he's into.
A lot of people
will
say
that work or not?
And I think it's mentioned in this piece again that Leo apparently studied the Bertie playbook, and that if there is a descendant of Bertie,
we're all being very mellow about Bertie Ahern here.
But let's not forget that there are a lot of people who think that Bertie Ahern is a disgraced politician, and that he was up to his neck in all kinds of stuff, and a lot of people aren't that forgiving about it. But is there a sense, Niamh, that Leo is more Bertie than he is anything else?
I think he'd hate to be compared to Bertie Ahern.
Trudeau, maybe.
But I think he does like to do the kind of something for everyone aspect of the job. Andy Kenny was frequently at Bruce Springsteen concerts, and there probably wouldn't have been as much commentary around that as there was about the Taoiseach going to a Spice Girls concert. But I guess, like, he's sort of, because he's that bit younger, he is kind of on that trendy circuit, as it was. Like, his friends, he would say, were the ones who took the picture of him at LCD, that no one would have really known that he was there if it wasn't. I suppose the idea as well that, you know, are we now looking for that new modern, as you say, Trudeau, Obama, all leaders now are in that kind of, I suppose, cast. You look even at Vladimir Putin, who's kind of never not pictured bare-chested on top of a boar, you know, with a fishing rod in one hand and a gun in the other shooting a deer. You know, like, everybody wants to see the certain vision of themselves through their own leader. And I mean, in this country, Leo puts himself at a gig with 80,000 Spice Girls fans. That's all anybody else was talking about that weekend.
Yeah, no, we should say as well that this kind of thing can backfire badly on you as well. Who was looking at Shane Ross in the Sunday Indo about Katie's homecoming was pure paradise?
That was me as well. I mean, I suppose he has his tongue firmly in his cheek, in fairness to him, because I think he realised that
he had to
laughing stock. He said that his grandchildren got quite a kick out of all the different memes that they saw Shane Ross being put into. You know, he was kind of
just for people who missed it.
Yeah,
this was that Katie Taylor's homecoming and Shane Ross by her side, fearlessly and proudly for every picture.
Mm. Now, in fairness to him, he said, look, if I hadn't done it, you would criticise me. He also described that Katie Taylor and her manager didn't want it to happen, and that he really had to force their hand to say, no, we should have a crowd. And then he kind of said, the reason I was standing next to her a little bit was I had a little speech to say that I never got to say. But he did shamelessly parody himself in saying, yes, I have a huge ego, and that's why I was hanging out beside her, because who wouldn't want to be next to this amazing woman and be photographed with her.
It was actually the contrast between, I suppose, Shane Ross as he describes his own ego and just how sort of unassuming Katie Taylor is. He speaks about one incident where he leaves the arena in Rio when she lost that crucial fight when she was contesting a medal. And he saw two women trying to flag down a taxi. They were pulling their suitcases behind them, and it was Katie and her mom. After losing that fight. I was hoping he pulled in and gave her a lift.
We don't know if he actually did or not.
He doesn't say.
He says, I got out, I sympathised, I shook her hand. Yeah. And I was like, and what? Did he drive off? No, when I saw the headline of the article, A Monstrous Ego and Katie Taylor, so it's in the Sunday Independent, I was like, yes, thank God someone has actually pinpointed this. You know, this is great. And then I kind of continued on, it's like, by Shane Ross. And I was like, what? I think he had no choice but to own it. There was a really Waterford Whisper News that I follow on Facebook, like who kind of do all these parody articles, and they had a very, very funny one about the whole Shane Ross scenario, and kind of like that Katie Taylor won, and you know, Shane Ross could be seen in a baby kind of swing in front of her. I think he had no choice but to own it. It was cringy. I thought it was really cringy, but at the same time, I think Norris hit the nail on the head. Like, he'd be, you know, damned if he didn't, damned if he did. And I think I really wish that the talk wasn't about Shane Ross, because I think the talk really actually should be about Katie and the incredible achievement.
And I think there is a lot of that as well, in fairness.
It's unfortunate the focus has shifted.
I think, you know, getting your head into photographs where you don't really deserve to be is often counterproductive. I mean, we all remember Charlie Haughey turning up in Paris for the Tour de France. But a point just struck me as you were speaking there, that 10 minutes ago we were talking about the Trump visit. And we were talking about people wanting to be seen with him, wanting to have dinner with him, wanting to be photographed on the golf course and almost to touch the hem of his garment, looking for the celebrity moment, as somebody said. So Shane Ross isn't on his own on this. There is a sort of wider societal phenomenon of wanting to be seen with famous people.
Yeah.
Okay, now, on another note entirely, Niamh, you were looking at the Sunday Times page for rising cocaine poisoning cases, and there's been a lot of stories about cocaine during the week. I think we're the third highest users in the EU, apparently. But it definitely sounds as if cocaine is very much back in the frame in this country.
Yeah, and I know it might sound like an obvious point, but the point made in that article is the idea that, obviously, our cocaine use went down during the recession years and has now steadily increased since 2013. But I suppose I just think that this presents a huge policy problem and challenge for the government, because we don't really need fresh legislation to tackle any of the problems with cocaine. We just need very specific strategies. You know, a lot of what we do at the moment would be around community policing, or it would be around targeting kind of polydrug use in particular areas through the National Drug Strategy. And every so often you'll see the junior minister responsible in that area, Catherine Byrne, giving extra money. I think most recently was in March, she gave another €1 million in that area. But we're failing to tackle the problem, I suppose, from the perspective of people simply have more spending power at the moment. We're close to becoming a society with full employment again. So now that's simply something that's once
it's
affordable
for
those using it recreationally that I'm talking about.
And this is, there is this difference between the Michael Goves of the world and then other people. Irene, I presume, are you seeing this at the coalface of criminal law?
Totally. So I had a conversation, I actually only said it yesterday in court, but I had a conversation with a colleague about 3 years ago. So you would see there's Section 3 simple possessions is what we would call them. So it's Section 3 of the Misuse of Drugs Act. And like routinely when the recession was in full flow, it was always kind of the odd bit of cannabis really that it was what you were seeing coming through the courts. But definitely 2.5-3 years ago, there was a lot more Section 3 possessions of cocaine. And I turned around and I made a comment. I was like, geez, it's a sure sign of the times that the country's doing better, because the cocaine possession is now kind of back in the main mix. But, pardon the pun, but I went and I was talking, so I've kind of done a bit of market research, for want of a better way of putting it, with some clients in terms of why it is that it's not so popular, but why it's given rise to such difficulties in terms of management and policing and the gang related issues. So I'm reliably told that a kilo of cocaine to buy in is €48,500. And by the time that filters down, basically the profit to be made on that is four times that. So for every kilo of cocaine that comes into the country, a dealer makes 200,000. So you take out your cost and you're left with 200,000. So it's no wonder that there's such huge gang wars going on when that's the amount of profit that can be made. And there was a very interesting piece. Michael O'Sullivan, who's a former assistant commissioner, was speaking with Sean O'Rourke during the week. And he's now involved in trying to kind of stem the flow of drugs from Europe. And he was saying that they think, it's very hard to estimate, but they think they only kind of stop about 10% of the drugs coming into Europe from Colombia, which is where kind of the main source of cocaine would come from, whereas the opiates come from a particularly good opiate crop in Afghanistan last year. But he was saying that they kind of gauge it around 10%. So if you take it that 90% of the drugs are still getting into the country, and that's the amount of profit that can be made on simply just 1 kilo of cocaine. Like, it's enormous.
Can I just one second, Norga? The kind of people who are being caught for these Section 3s, What is the profile there? Is it different to everyone, what we might expect?
Yeah, everyone. So if I can say traditionally, so recession times when it was more cannabis related possession, you would generally have kind of young male, late teens, early 20s. Certainly now you have guys and girls, and they're not, I suppose the people that are targeted are still, they tend to be in their early 20s or late teens, because I'm not saying they're a bit more stupid in terms of detection. I don't mean that in a bad sense, but I think the older users tend to be a bit more cautious in terms of, you know, okay, not carrying it in their pocket, not having it in the passenger glove compartment or that type of a thing. But it's across the board.
Okay, Bobby.
Just to say, there's another cocaine story this week, of course, because Michael Gove has been boasting about it.
Yeah, and we'll come to that in a while. Nora.
I was going to say, even with the profit that you're talking about, it's still relatively cheap. And one issue which is pretty significant, I think, in terms of catching these criminals is it's mostly online. I work with a group of young people, mostly young men in their teenage, late teens, young adults, and they use Instagram for all of their drug purchases. So they don't have to go down a back alley. They don't have to buy in a nightclub.
So this is the Uberization that we heard about.
Yeah, there's private Instagram sites. You can't, they're not open. You follow them. They'll do a bit of research on you to make sure that you're not, you know, the drug squad. And if they get a good recommendation for you, you then join that Instagram group. And literally you can order your drugs at whatever time, meet you at the Lewis stop at 4 o'clock and I'll pick them up. And by the way, when they go abroad
and
on holidays,
Instagram don't endorse any of this, and are actively working
while they're on holidays.
I think it's across social media, full stop.
I know
the web in general.
Snapchat is one that's been used. Again, I'm sure they don't endorse it, but because obviously the pictures disappear quickly,
it's difficult to catch up with all this. And there's in no sense are we suggesting that they're in any way responsible for any of this. Listen, I want to talk briefly about insurance, because it's obviously dragging on and on and on. I think a lot of people are finding it kind of hard to follow aspects of what's going on here around the compo culture. But there is a piece in the Sunday Business Post today, the front page, it's slash premiums if you want injury payouts reduced. So they're putting it back on to the insurance companies as well. Yeah. Who was looking at that?
I was looking at that. Yeah. So basically 760 cases of fraudulent claims were sent to the Gardaí in 2018. And they also say 18 solicitors have stopped using, they call them the compo culture harvesting websites, equivalent of ambulance chasing online, I'd say. But what's really interesting about this piece, Michael Darcy, who's the Minister of State responsible for this area at DEFRA, he's saying, okay, but you guys also need to reduce premiums. Lots of small businesses, lots of people, they say 1,147 people declined 3 times insurance cover. And to put it into context, although that cost the insurance industry a great deal, those fraudulent claims, in 2014 they put insurance premiums up by 11%, 15 by 30%, 16 by 12%. The profits on motor insurance alone for the insurance industry in Ireland last year was 31.1 million. And in the non life insurance area, 126 million. So we're not talking about, I know that we have spent the last month or two saying it's disgraceful, and it is disgraceful when people take claims that are fraudulent. There are legitimate claims out there, and this is a group of companies that are now actually making a significant amount of money. I just want to say one more thing. Drew Harris, one of the expected things to have happened was that the Gardaí would set up a special unit for fraudulent claims, and Drew Harris has come out now and said he's not going to set that unit up. So that's a source of contention for the insurance industry.
And it's a strategic decision for him that he feels it's better done locally. within local areas. Who looked at the Sunday Times page 2 about councils cracking under paving claims? 1,000 claims last year?
Yeah, same thing.
It comes down to more or less the same issue. I suppose what the article speaks to is that it shouldn't really be about reducing the number of claims, that it actually should be about improving conditions. And there was one very important line in it. And we all see it, a lot of the pavements are kind of gone to pot, and it's to do with trees and the tree roots and the expansion of all that, which probably maybe wasn't foreseen. But one of the lines in it was saying it's not so much about the claim culture or reducing the payments, but in fact it's trying to increase the accessibility and the availability for people who have, you know, limited limited abilities in terms of how they get around. So if you have footpaths that literally kind of fully able-bodied individuals can't maneuver properly, you know, where does that leave kind of wheelchair people or people that have walking difficulties or anything to that effect?
People with impairment vision,
anything at all.
With buggies and, you know, the whole parking up.
And I think that was a very important, you know, aside from the claiming culture or the compensation aspect, I actually think that was a very important point that's missed a lot of the time. That, you know, there is a greater purpose maybe to some of these instances.
And that
some
the
of
only
instances.
Real solution for that industry is people's own honesty. We saw that from Fran McNulty's brilliant piece on, was it Prime Time during the week, Brass Necks, people with whiplash, claiming for whiplash when there hadn't even been an impact in the car. You know, and I suppose it goes back to the Maria Bailey thing as well. I mean, when Heather Humphreys, the business minister, was speaking about this during Leaders' Questions in the Dáil last week, she was raising the point that, you know, kids are falling down now in the likes of playgroups and play centres, and parents are claiming, whereas when you fell down the schoolyard as a kid, you dusted yourself down and you got back to it. You know, I remember, you know, coming over, you know, to my mother with a sore knee, and the thing was, yeah, you know, you're all right, go back off and play.
Now it's did anyone witness it? Yeah. For some people, and there are a lot of people make legitimate claims out there as well, and they're perfectly entitled to. We'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel's still here. Bobby McDonagh, Niamh Lyons, Irene Sands, Conor Brophy and Nora Casey. And we can't ignore Rockall. I don't think anyone expected this to happen right now, but we seem to have an international situation. Bobby, can you give us a bit of background to what's going on here?
Well, as you say, it's all come up very suddenly, but to me it's surprising and strange. I mean, it's surprising because Scotland and Ireland have very good relations, and Nicola Sturgeon met the Taoiseach in Dublin 10 days ago and it wasn't raised at that level. So it seems like a fairly dramatic evolution from it not having been raised at the highest level to an announcement that from midnight tonight boats are going to be excluded or detained. It's strange for three reasons. First of all, because Scotland is not an independent country, at least not yet. And any sovereignty claim over Rockall can only be that of the United Kingdom, not of Scotland. And yet it's the Scottish government which wants independence, not the UK government in London, that's taking this initiative.
And apparently Whitehall are kind of urging them to calm it down.
Obviously, I don't know what they're saying at the moment, but this is a Scottish government initiative. So in a way, they're asserting UK sovereignty when the government of the UK is not doing so.
Yeah.
At least the UK government believes in the sovereignty of Rockall, but it's not pursuing it in this particular way.
Right now, yeah.
The second thing that's strange is that the SNP's case for Scottish independence is based on a wish and what they see as a right to be part of the European Union as an independent Scotland. And it seems to me that this type of unilateral measure in relation to waters which have been treated as part of the common fisheries policy is precisely how not to win friends in Europe. In a way, you have a Brexit card being played by elements in a Scottish government which is against Brexit. And then the third reason that I find it strange is that Nicola Sturgeon has carefully built up a very well-deserved reputation for calm competence in relation to many issues, which will certainly not be helped by this. So, look, I think the government's here, its initial reaction is low-key and correct. Hopefully this can be solved in a political sort of way. But as I say, I think it's surprising and strange.
But it seems like we could be on the verge now of one of our boats. And I thought it was extraordinary. They come from as far as Castletown Bear to get up there. Such is the richness of, I think, it's squid, a lot of which there are no quotas on squid. And then there seems to be a lot of cod up there as well. Very rich waters.
Brendan, when I was growing up, my father used to make us sing that song, Rock On, Rock All, We'll Never Fall. But I'll tell you, I always thought it was just off the coast of Donegal. And then when you look at it geographically, it's about 420 odd kilometres northwest of Donegal and about 320 kilometres northwest of Scotland. So Scotland have claimed it as their own, but there's a UN convention on the laws of the sea, and they say unless it's inhabited, you can't claim it as your own. So at the moment, Britain has claimed it in 1955. They got on the rock and they hammered the Union Jack onto it.
There's great footage of Marines coming down from a helicopter. Yes. And yeah.
So they hammered
and
Union Jack onto it.
I think there was another guy who spent 25 days there to stay.
Yeah, on
Britain's
a loop
claim.
Of rope saying it was Britain's.
So there's tied to the rock, literally.
So what Britain has done is it's put a claim in to the UN Convention of the Land of the Sea, whatever it is. Ireland has put in a counterclaim and Iceland has put in
now,
a claim.
Ireland hasn't, as I understand it, Bobby, would I be right in saying Ireland does not claim sovereignty over
counterclaim.
I think the basic point is that we don't accept British sovereignty.
It's a counterclaim.
And then I believe, are the Danes in it through the Faroe Islands as well?
Yes, there's four. That's right, the Faroe Islands as well. So this
like a bad UEFA for qualifying.
I really did. Look, in my mind as a child, is thinking that's just off the coast of Ireland. That's why we're fighting over it. It's way in the middle of nowhere between here and Iceland.
Yeah, but clear, as well as the richness of fish, is not that we'll be drilling for any more oil and gas, but there's obviously oil and gas to be had as well. Is there, Conor, what do you make of it?
You can't underestimate the potential for rocky outcrops in the middle of the sea to cause or be at the centre of conflicts. You know, Las Malvinas, Iwo Jima, Rockall, thankfully nothing of the same magnitude being discussed, but it's a fascinating thing in human history that we always seem to end up rowing over relatively inhabitable and inhospitable places jutting out in the middle of the ocean, albeit with the rich aquatic life that it has floating around.
Irene?
There was a fishing dispute and my fishing information will be fairly limited, but there was a dispute that happened locally up in Louth whereby it was back in March, whereby two Northern Ireland vessels were actually seized by the Irish Navy, and they were docked in Aclarahead, which is a fishing port in Louth. And it escalated into court proceedings and the two captains being brought before the courts. And the judge, you know, indicated that the captains themselves were impeccable individuals and applied the Probation Act and the vessels were released and all that. But at that time, it highlighted the fact that really there needs to be a better agreement in place between Ireland and the UK in terms of the fishing rights in general. And I think...
Yeah, there seemed to be vagueness over that agreement between the North and South, wasn't there?
Absolutely.
And it's dragged on for a long time without being actually...
The Northern boats aren't permitted. My understanding is they aren't permitted to fish in Ireland, but the Irish boats are permitted to fish up on the northern waters of the British waters. So I think the whole area is one that probably needs a little bit of clarification.
Okay, yeah,
including
I don't know
Rockall.
The exact details of that either, but look we'll take it as that and I'm sure somebody will tell us very quickly if we're wrong anyway. Niamh, from a political point of view, this is a very strange thing to happen right now, isn't it?
It's something that actually fisheries will come massively into play in the next phase of Brexit whenever we get there as well. Trying to divide up the waters on that basis could get very awkward. Maybe that's why Scotland, I don't know, are making some kind of play here. They're sort of, you know, getting their excuses in early. That bit's ours, just in case anybody needs to know. But definitely not something anybody expected coming up.
Okay, so we could be seeing the price of calamari go up for a while now, I think. Let's look briefly at the environment as well, because I know you wanted to talk about farmers and drivers face penalties under new carbon budget. Who was looking at that?
Oh, yeah, that was me. And also there's another story on page one, Stephen O'Brien in the Sunday Times saying that the government's about to give the green light to allow people to sell electricity back to the grid. So all of these are variations on the same theme. The Climate Action Minister, Richard Bruton, has a plan that has been fairly broadly trailed now throughout the media over a number of weeks. And I suppose there's a few kind of carrot and stick type approaches in there. And one of them would be the idea, I don't know if anyone has ever watched Grand Designs, and you see these kind of suitably smug people have spent like £1 million on a house that's made out of kind of like tires and twigs, and it ends up being passive, and these people get a little check at the end of the year from their electricity company, be it British Gas or whoever they're supplied by. And in this country, we simply haven't been able to do that. Any extra supply is simply just wasted or spilled, as it's called. So the government kind of want to incentivize you to get your homes to that point where you're so efficient. I mean, we have A3 rated homes here, but this would be homes that are so efficient they actually generate electricity, and that's obviously through solar power. So they're saying that under this scheme, that could yield about €400 a year for a household. And I definitely think that really what the government are onto here is that if their actions and if spending a little bit of money in trying to get your home or change your lifestyle, if spending a bit of money, then you get a payoff down through the years. And that's what this whole idea with the carbon tax plus dividend model is about, the idea that the government
so this
wants
does not mean we're all going to pay that, you know, we like the idea of green, but then it'll come down to paying for it in carbon taxes and then we'll all go, oh no, we don't like it, that they're going to try and make it attractive for
us. And there's a kind of a PR job that at the moment is being lost on the government side, because I suppose it's becoming a bit of a water charges Mark II issue, where it's sort of nobody wants to have a bill for the green measures that they implement. But some of the talk from the Climate Action Plan is the idea that you will have schemes that are going to be rolled out at local level for people to avail of to try and get their house up to standard. I think it was the European Investment Bank that estimated to get all of our buildings in this country back up to high energy efficiency standards, it would cost something like 80 billion euro. That's not something that a government will ever be able to help you with. They'll never even be able to meet sufficient grants for that type of thing. But if people take responsibility for doing it, and it is a big ask, I mean, you're talking for retrofitting, you're talking about the idea of ripping out boilers, probably going through kitchens and, you know, pulling out floors upstairs. So it's a huge ask of people, but it's where the government are kind of minded to go with this action plan.
Irene.
Niamh was saying about the carrot and the stick scenario there. I think there's an article on the front page of the Sunday Business Post, which is Michael Brennan's, in relation to farmers and drivers to face penalties under the carbon budget, which definitely seems to be more of the stick approach, I think, than the carrot. The article essentially goes on to the fact that there's going to be different targets for different sectors, and that there's going to be 5-year targets with 3 separate budgets over the next 15 years, and that each sector will have a certain target that they have to reach accordingly, and the end result obviously being to bring down carbon emissions. But I suppose the incentive being that if they don't hit their targets, they then are liable to penalties. So rather than an enticement,
Looks like you're vilifying a particular sector.
I would say that half the people at home don't even know what we're talking about, because although Britain may be in a shambles over Brexit, they have their climate action plan really nailed down. So zero carbon emissions by 2050, very clear targets on moving completely over to electric cars by 2030, no fossil fuels, moving to clean energy. So they have a special committee that's set up talking about climate plans and actions, and there's no offset of carbon tax. So in other words, there's no offset in the future that you can say, well, we might have burned a bit of carbon, but there's a few bob for you just to make up for it. We have to be responsible for our emissions. So why the government doesn't set up a proper committee and a commission like they have in the UK to make it clear for everybody? I can tell you, every time I have a conversation with somebody, I don't know what's going on in that field. I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, Colin McMillan has a very good...
I generally want
in
a
his
climate.
First piece for the Sunday Business Post on page 17, Colin McMillan has... links this all back to the Trump visit, and the Taoiseach in his questioning after the visit got questioned himself on why he hadn't really taken Donald Trump to task about his record in climate change, and the Taoiseach had to admit, well, we have a poor record ourselves.
We really can't
start speaking down to other countries unless we're kind of talking the talk and walking the walk ourselves.
Okay, now I have bad news for Jeremy Hunt. We got on to a spokesperson for Minister Simon Coveney about Jeremy Hunt claiming on Sky News that Angela Merkel had told him that the deal could be renegotiated, and Simon Coveney says the withdrawal agreement is negotiated and closed. Jean-Claude Juncker, Donald Tusk, Michel Barnier, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron have repeatedly and consistently said so. Simon Coveney is always having to call out Tory leadership candidates.
Dominic Raab has done it a number of times for telling little
porkies like that. Briefly, Bobby.
Sorry, just very briefly, but look, my concern here is not the backstop is going to be changed. It's not. My concern is that the next leader of the Tory party is going to be elected on the basis of a false prospectus. Mm. I mean, there's a few candidates who don't have a huge amount of support who are telling the truth. And then you have the crazies who, you know, regard it as a matter of pride to crash out of the European Union and damage the UK economy. And then you have the people in the middle who would be the normal centrists like Javid and Hunt and Gove and so on in any normal circumstances, who are saying, oh, we're going to renegotiate the backstop.
Yeah, exactly.
And the fact is, if one of them is elected, they're going to go to Europe, they're going to be told no, they're going to kick up a big fuss, and there's a real risk of a no-deal Brexit if they're elected on a prospectus that is simply untrue.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break.